Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
What started as a traffic stop July 10th quickly escalated.
I am getting removed for a failure.
Step out or I will remove you. I'm giving you a lawful order.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Texas State Trooper Brian Encinia took Sandra Bland to jail. 3 days later, authorities in Waller County, northwest of Houston, said they found her dead in her jail cell. In June, McKinney Police Corporal David Eric Casebolt resigned after forcing a teenage girl to the ground and kneeling on her back during an incident at a pool party.
Oh, my God! Oh, my mama! Oh, God!
Hey, Rick!
Down!
Down!
On your face!
Those citizen police encounters came about due to different circumstances, and they had very different outcomes. What they had in common is that both individuals who appeared to be treated with undue harshness were African American, and the officers were not. In light of other recent cases, Eric Garner pleading, "I can't breathe," with officers who had him in a chokehold for selling loose cigarettes. Michael Brown being shot by police in Ferguson, Missouri after an alleged petty theft at a convenience store. And yesterday's indictment of a University of Cincinnati police officer on a murder charge in the shooting death of motorist Sam DuBose. Some Americans see an unmistakable pattern of abuse of black people by police. It's a pattern many African Americans say is old and familiar, but has been largely ignored by white Americans until recently, when pervasive video footage has seared images of these events into all of our minds. We have three guests who will talk with us about this hour. As it happens, all of them are African American. Christopher Blay is a curator, artist, and blogger. Meredith Clark is assistant professor of journalism at the University of North Texas. Cheryl Wilson is chief of the Lancaster Police Department. She is on her way. She's stuck in North Texas traffic. We will welcome her when she arrives here. But Meredith and Christopher, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Meredith Clark, when you listen to clips like the ones we played, do you imagine yourself in the same situation?
Absolutely. I drive through North Texas a lot. I'm back and forth going to the airport, and since I live in Denton, there's a long stretch of road there. And I wonder what it would be like if I were pulled over by an officer and hazard to question why I was being pulled over. I've been pulled over 4 times in the last year, and I really try to avoid conflict because I never want that interaction to escalate any further in the way that it did with Sandra Bland's case.
4 times in a year sounds like a lot. I'm going to assume that you're a decent driver. Do you think that your appearance has anything to do with how often you've been stopped?
Oddly enough, no. In my case, I have an old car, and I'd park it at the airport and find out on my way home that a light was blown out. So I fixed all the lights on my car and continue to drive back and forth.
Christopher Blay, what has your experience been with police in Texas as a black man?
It's been largely positive, I'll say. But with the caveat that I don't believe that it has to personally happen to someone for it to be a concern. For a long time, I drove what most would classify as a cop magnet. I had a 1972 Cadillac Coupe de Ville. It's a black car, large car, and I had circumstances where I was pulled over just because of the the appearance of nefarious activity, but my experience...
Excuse me for interrupting. When you say appearance of nefarious activity, what do you mean?
I mean a large black Cadillac driving at night anywhere gives the suggestion that this is sort of like a typical car, like a criminal car. And I don't know if it would be different if I was anyone other than a black male in America, but those are the circumstances. And but yeah, my experience has been largely positive, and but again, I don't see that as a reason to be silent when the news headlines are the way they are, because I think once if it happens to anyone, it should be a concern to everyone, because as a black person in America, you're literally one stop away from a potentially dangerous circumstance with the police.
Do you think it's a problem that in many cases we're still talking about this as an African-American problem instead of as an American problem and simply being concerned regardless of race for our fellow citizens who in these cases happen to be black, who are clearly coming in for treatment that is inappropriate?
Well, in that context, it feels like it's not a situation where you're going out there and saying there's something wrong everywhere you go or in every circumstance. But I feel like it's something that's happening more and more, and it's probably been happening for a very long time. And it's only with the advent of outlets like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube that there's greater public awareness, where in circumstances before, it may have been a news story buried on the second or third page or an incendiary incident that's on the front page. This is sort of... it feels like there's nothing else on the news over the past 12 months. Just when one story is subsiding, another incident happens. And I think we should all be concerned about it.
Chief Cheryl Wilson, I want to welcome you in person. I'm glad you made it. You're in studio now. I'm really interested in your perspective on this. You are chief of police in a city with a majority African-American population. I think in the 2000 census, it was like 54% or something. Does the demographic breakdown within your department reflect the population of the city?
No. We're working on it. Actually, we're still working on just getting the best qualified. However, through that process, we've been able to close the gap a little bit. This last year, we've hired 4 African Americans, 2 African American females, 2 African American males. So it does help out as far as on the bottom line, the first responders and the relationship with the community as a whole. To close that gap of the disparities that we have as far as representing the community.
I've heard other police chiefs of other cities saying they would like to hire more African-American officers. There's a recruitment challenge because if you are from a community that has learned not to trust the police, why would you be the thing that your family and friends say, you know, tread carefully around this person?
I think that's kind of a myth, because we get our fair share of good, equal, across the board applicants that come in and apply. But and maybe I'm lucky, I don't know, from that perspective. And sometimes I wonder, because we have been so fortunate, that if it's because I'm African American that I am drawing more of an African American base as far as who is actually applying for the job. But along those lines, I know this is going to be off a little bit, but I believe that we have to teach our youth and put them in youth programs early, because what they do in the past is part of the background process that can disqualify them. So that strong base, family values, morals, peer pressure plays a role in if you're qualified or not for the position. So that's one of the main things that will disqualify you from being a police officer.
All right. In terms of the videos, and we need to be careful because they are all separate incidents. They have some factors in common, but it's not entirely fair to sort of assume that they are all the same thing or that they will all be resolved in the same way. But when you see these videos, how do you look at them and what are you looking for that might be of use to you in terms of training your officers and anticipating problems that could arise and could be prevented?
Absolutely. And I look at all of my, I stay on CNN just for that review of a briefing on what training we need. Like last year, we did the simulator training for the entire department and we invited the citizens. And the simulator training was based on use of force, when and when not to use it, how do you de-escalate situations before they become more of a lethal decision that you have to make. In regard to that, I think when you look at the videos and everything, law enforcement as a whole has to get to the point that we embrace the idea of early warning signs. And what would that require us to do? What emotional intelligence exams or tests we could give to monitor our officers' mindset and behavior. Some of that is things you can't train because you can't see it until it actually happens. However, if we put the right mechanisms in place, such as early warning signs, you know, same officers getting complaints on the same type of issues, that you kind of draw to them and see how can you help them to change maybe a bias or their behaviors as a whole. So nobody likes to talk about emotional intelligence too much, but I think in some of these situations you will notice that they were emotionally hijacked, which determined the outcome of that situation.
All right, I want to throw out a question that maybe all of you can respond to, and Meredith, maybe you can first. Why have the videos made this conversation something that is top of mind when it appears evident that we've had problems like this for decades in this country, but they have not really been things? You know, Christopher was saying they would get buried maybe on a second page, below the fold kind of headline.
Well, the videos make things evident. They make them impossible to ignore. What you're seeing in a video is a living, breathing, speaking person asserting their rights, speaking back to an authority, and you can't look away from that. It's easy to dismiss the statistics that we read about policing and how policing works. It's easy to dismiss the cases that we read about people when their descriptions don't match our own lives, but it's a lot harder to ignore an image of a person, a moving image of a person that has sound, where we can identify human interaction. And so keeping that front of mind kind of makes the problem real for people as they watch it.
Yeah, and you also have to look at the relationship between police and African Americans in a historical context, because out of context, you can make the assertion that if this person only complied or wasn't talking back to an officer, then things would have de-escalated. And in the Sandra Bland case, she would have only gotten a ticket. But in historical context of the way African Americans have been treated by police in America, it's a violent past. And, you know, we shouldn't be talking about it in 2015 because we live in a society where we believe we've made a lot of progress, and we have made a lot of progress. But progress for some doesn't indicate progress for all. And until we can just sort of guarantee something as basic as equal rights and justice and equal treatment under the law, I'm afraid we'll keep having these conversations. And individual culpability isn't something that should be the primary concern. Systemic evaluation and addressing things like this should be more of the topic.
We're talking about race and law enforcement in Texas on Think. My guests are artists Christopher Blay, Meredith Clark, who is assistant professor of journalism at the University of North Texas, and Lancaster Police Chief Cheryl Wilson. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about race and law enforcement in North Texas. By the way, in light of the Sandra Bland case, State Representative Garnett Coleman of Houston, who is chairman of the Texas House Committee on County Affairs, is holding a Texas House Committee hearing this afternoon to look at trooper arrest procedures and state jail standards. We will have more on that hearing this evening during All Things Considered. Back now to our conversation with our three guests. They are Lancaster Police Chief Cheryl Wilson, Assistant Professor of Journalism at the University of North Texas, Meredith Clark, and curator, artist, and blogger Christopher Blay. You can be part of the conversation by finding me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I'm curious about the impact of zero-tolerance disciplinary policies in schools in many parts of Texas and how any of you think that these might relate to an antagonistic relationship between individuals who might commit a minor infraction of some kind and authority figures in general and police in particular.
I think there's definitely a relationship. When you consider a report that was released by a couple of researchers at Villanova in 2013 that indicated that darker-skinned African-American children were punished more harshly for minor infractions. That's part of the schema that Sandra Bland brought to this interaction. And you have to question what previous treatment she had received through the educational system, through prior interactions with law enforcement that she brought to this particular stop. That she perceived she was being treated unfairly and decided that this was the time that she was going to stand up for herself.
Chief, can you speak to the question of the way officers are trained, and just you can speak to your own department, you don't have to speak to America in general, with regard to, I know there are times when somebody is stopped or pulled over or detained in some way and they're really respectful. There are times when people are really irritated. How much is an officer allowed to sort of demand politeness, not simply acquiescence from someone that they have detained?
It's not a matter that they demand it. Their level of professionalism, law enforcement ethics and principles, we are above that perspective. Anybody, it's natural that if you get stopped or you think you're going to get a ticket, that the person is going to be a little upset. And what I tell my officers is you're in control by your mere presence. All the other going back and forth, having a negative interaction does not solve the problem. It escalates the problem. And ultimately, it escalates that they feel that they need to use the use of force continuum in a manner that may not necessarily be justifiable based on a verbal interaction, if that makes sense. It escalates, like the University of Cincinnati PD. That situation escalated. Sandra Bland, that escalated based on a verbal conversation that ended up using lethal. I mean, not in Sandra Bland's place, but in the case of the University of Cincinnati PD. So my expectation is a little bit higher. We were talking earlier. I look for more of the servant leadership, the guardianship, and that perspective. There's another word out there called procedural justice, where we will respect others at all times, regardless of what their verbal conversation may be or that confrontation may be. That's not necessarily a threat.
Yeah, and I also see it as there doesn't have to justice and equal and fair treatment doesn't need the prerequisite of politeness. I feel that it's important to speak up for your rights when you're aware of them. And this perception that there's also a disparity with the way people that speak up are treated. There are innumerous videos on YouTube of white people confronting the police vehemently and loudly and abrasively, and cops stand there and take it. So the perception is that you can do that if you're white, and if you're black and do that, your constitutional rights are immediately null and void, and you're a threat to an officer. So, I mean, I think that I'm glad you said something about training, because I think the training does help and should help, but I think there also needs to be some sort of legislative remedy that guarantees the rights of all citizens, the rights of everyone under the law, so that when a cop pulls someone over, even if that person's in a bad mood, give them a ticket, or if they do something that, you know, an arrestable infraction, yeah, follow the procedures and explicitly, you know, you're in control. You're right. They're the person with the gun, so they're in control. But I don't think individual constitutional and basic human rights should be sort of like put on the back burner in those circumstances. Not that.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the way I feel about that.
All right, I want to raise a question here that I think there are people in our audience asking, which is this question, you know, these cases that we have seen appear on the face of them pretty clearly to have something to do with the race of the suspect or the person who was stopped for some reason. But in most of the cases, there were not particular verbal references made to race. There were not epithets used. And so how do we wrestle with the question that maybe some white people have, like maybe this is just a case of a case gone bad and it had nothing to do with race, whereas I think to many people of color, it seems evident that race was a factor, but it's hard to prove or disprove something like this, whether it's a factor of race on an individual level or it's simply a systemic reality in terms of the way white people and black people or people of color and white people interact with one another.
I think in law enforcement, one of the things we have to guard against is biases and stereotypes. And it's the unconscious one that, you know, that you don't realize that you're actually doing, is why I say we need to move toward more of a behavior science, that we can monitor that by, you know, a requirement of every 2 years to have some type of behavior testing or examinations done to identify some of those factors. It's very easy to do. As a matter of fact, I just talked to a couple officers yesterday in regards to, yeah, we may, you know, 20% of our citizens may not necessarily be, you know, our greatest citizens in our communities, but that's not the 80%. So each encounter has to be treated differently. You cannot take one encounter and roll it over to the next one when it's just a law-abiding citizen that you stopped and it's already escalated just based off your last traffic stop or your last encounter.
So you're already having a bad day, but you have to not bring that with you to the next
It can happen
stop.
Every day because of the calls of service. You know, you can go from having an assault family violence call that's a little more escalated, and then you can go from to having a just meet the complainant call in regards to a burglary. So, you know, in between those, you have to be able to separate the two and understand the audience or the person that you're actually talking to. But it carries over. It's easy to do at times when you're getting calls like back to back. So you're going from one emotional swing to the next emotional swing. But I think the biggest thing is that we encounter basically the same 20%, but for the most part, that is not the majority. So we have to keep that in mind and keep in mind our biases that we can actually have and not realizing that we do. From a bad driver, this is not necessarily based on race. This could be based on a lot of different factors.
Meredith Clark, do you believe we've built a system that makes it easier for white officers, non-minority officers who've had a few bad incidents to take out their frustrations on a person of color than to take out their frustrations on a white person?
Absolutely. I think it's easy when people try to rationalize that just because someone isn't being called a name or being roughed up and there's not a reference to their skin color, that that's not racism. When an officer approaches a person, if they are already thinking about the last call that they had with a black person, that is racism in action. That is latent racism at work. It doesn't have to be so profound in that you call me names. It's that you're applying a negative experience you had in one case to another case. And that's problematic to me as an average citizen, where I'm just trying to deal with law enforcement and go about my way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Charlie in Highland Village. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Okay, everybody wants to have a conversation on race, so let's have a real one here. Every one of those encounters that you named at the top of the hour there, every encounter between a policeman and a citizen involves two parties. Both parties have a duty to keep it from escalating. Mm-hmm. Your talkers there seem to be concentrating on the police. When I look at that tape of Sandra Bland, I see a belligerent woman. I don't see a black woman. I see a belligerent woman who is not following orders.
Any thoughts, Chief?
I agree to his point. I guess is that we're not necessarily focusing on law enforcement. I don't think we're talking about our actions that we take and what make us do what we do or feel the threat when we are out making an encounter with a citizen. I think it's our job to, you know, understand what's a verbal confrontation and what's a threat versus a non-threat. A verbal confrontation is not a threat. It doesn't justify lethal force or to escalate, especially if the stop was on a Class C misdemeanor charge.
Well, I was going to say, excuse me for interrupting, I haven't seen 100 of these videos. I honestly don't know how it goes most of the time. To me, it sounded like Sandra Bland was simply saying, what, is there a law now that I have to put out my cigarette? She didn't seem to me to be trying to escalate the situation. She was irritated, but it didn't seem to me, just as a layperson observer, that she was doing anything that would call for her to be sort of dragged out of the car.
Exactly. And I mean, in the spirit of de-escalation and just the circumstance when a black person in America see police lights in their rearview mirror is not the same for everyone in the majority culture. It's different because there's a history and there's a context. A lot of people in the past have disappeared or have been violently treated without video. So the history coming from 40 and 50 years ago is something that is acutely placed in the minds of people in the African-American community. And some of the same, like the caller saying he didn't see a black woman but a belligerent woman that wasn't obeying the law. I think that's the general perception. It's this idea that black people need to stay in their place, especially in front of an officer, and that any sort of disagreement or any sort of reaction to commands like put out your cigarette in your own vehicle should never happen. And it would be okay if that was the case for everyone, but it's not the case for everyone. Some people in our society almost have that as an unwritten privilege to be able to talk back to police like that. But largely when African Americans do the same thing, the situation is looked at as a tender for escalation.
As a chief of police, I truly believe that there's a grave concern for the officer's safety as well as the citizen officer interaction in light of the national incidents that have occurred. They have really put us in the officers at a more heightened level, and so is the citizen. Kind of when you look at the Sandra Bland thing, everybody on both sides are at that stage. The officers want to go home at the end of the shift, and the citizens do not trust police anymore. So when we talk about the challenges that we face now in policing, we're all the way back to now trying to rebuild our public perception and trust in policing and what we do. So I feel that on both sides, it has heightened to the level that we have to have these conversations about what we actually see, and it's based on the outcome of these national incidents. It's been a white officer, it's been a African-American citizen, and it's been a consistent thing. Okay, when you first start watching it, you think, okay, isolated incident, you know, then they keep coming and they keep coming and they keep coming. It's like, okay, we need to pay attention to what's going on, and how do we turn this around, and how do we gain the public's trust back? There's thousands, millions, billions of officers that are doing the right thing every day. They're making the right decisions, and they're doing community policing. Is that, again, that 10% of our workforce that really damages our perception with the public? And we have to not ignore that and come up with ways to overcome that perception. And it is the topic of every conversation, because they just continue and continue to become more publicized because of social media, media outlets is out there. So we can't ignore that. We need to be concerned about officer safety, and we need to be concerned about citizen-officer interactions when we have them.
We're speaking this hour about race and law enforcement in Texas with Lancaster Police Chief Cheryl Wilson, with curator, artist, and blogger Christopher Blay, and with Meredith Clark, who is Assistant Professor of Journalism at the University of North Texas. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can call us at 800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour about race and law enforcement in Texas with curator, artist, and blogger Christopher Blay, Assistant Professor of Journalism at the University of North Texas, Meredith Clark, and Lancaster Police Chief Cheryl Wilson. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. So many people are outraged and angry and sad about the things that we have seen incontrovertible evidence of on video. What do we do with this anger besides talking about it? How do we take these feelings of outrage and turn them into something that, gives us a better society? Meredith, do you want to jump in on this?
Absolutely. I think you're seeing that with protests like Black Lives Matter, where people are mobilizing, they are getting out in the streets. They are interrupting the daily routines of individuals who would otherwise plead willful ignorance to what is happening in their own country. When people get out and protest and they ask political candidates about their stance on Black Lives Matter, when they ask for changes in policy, when they petition their government for redress of grievances, that is taking the talking to the next level.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I had this conversation with my daughter, Kara, this morning, and she said, yeah, it's great that you're going to be able to have a conversation, but it may not be reaching the people that need, or the people that need to hear this are probably not listening to KERA or NPR. But my counter to that is that because of the preponderance of media exposure, it eventually reaches a national conversation. And that sort of national conversation hopefully leads to a legislative resolution or recourse where it's not just a given that we are all equal and living in an equal society, but that we have specific legislation to address how certain aspects of policing happen. Like, what is the sort of law? What is the law when you're stopped by a police officer? I feel like that needs to be a very explicit legislative remedy, and how suspects, and they're all suspects until they're tried in a court of law, how suspects are treated in transport to police facilities and how they're treated in the system. And all these things have legislative remedies so that when incidents like this happen, we can compare the police response to the law and have a clear and explicit judicial remedy. So, yeah, I think it's important that it's in the news, and I hope that this sort of goes beyond talking about it and leads to politicians listening and citizens being more involved and legislation happening that define very specific procedures for the way police interact with everyone, but and that would cover the circumstances with African Americans.
And I feel like we have to keep working to earn our trust back and the public's perception. And we have to do that through community interaction and partnerships, civic engagement, community forums on the best Southwest side, Dallas, Duncanville, Cedar Hill, DeSoto, and Lancaster. We have regular forums, community forums, and we do it together, all the police chiefs, and give the citizens an opportunity to interact, to vent their frustrations, and to work real hard to overcome what some of those perceptions are of what we do. And we do a pretty good job of explaining it and overcoming it, some of those circumstances or those perceptions they have. And those outcomes have been great because there's things they didn't know that they know now. And it's a great opportunity just to interact. But my main focus, when you asked me earlier from watching CNN, is to stay involved in the community and keep a pulse on the community, a pulse on your department and areas that we need to continue to work on, and recognizing those early warning signs of one or two officers. It's never all of them. I know we're put under this blanket, but it's one or two. So if we can catch them early, and understand and kind of redirect their behaviors, that's our best outcome to overcoming some of these situations we're in now, into now.
I read an interesting perspective that said that the reason that, you know, for a certain segment of the U.S. population, evidence of racially motivated mistreatment seems very clear. For another segment of the population, it doesn't seem clear. Someone said, you know, we still live in pretty segregated communities. People don't necessarily have neighbors who look very different from them, whose incomes are very different from them. And so there may be a significant number of Americans who have never witnessed something that looks like mistreatment of a suspect by a police officer. Is this a factor, do you think, in the sort of chasm of experience and understanding between people who theoretically, a lot of people really want to do the right thing, but they want to believe that it's based in something they can understand.
Did you want to take
that? And if you, if you disagree, please jump in. It's just
I think it's goes back to just the context of race in America. We've never had a significant dialogue about the history of race in America.
Why?
Because it's challenging. It's admitting that slavery did occur. It's admitting that there's, you know, institutional, governmental, civic policy historically have relegated African Americans to ghettos, and those ghettos create a circumstance of desperation. You're trying to feed your family, you're trying to stay alive in the same circumstance where you have lack of public transportation, you can't afford a vehicle, you have to maintain your vehicle with all these fees and charges, like for inspection and registration. And when you get to that point where you're being penalized for not having those things and then being criminalized for not being able to pay those fines, and those fines are going to the coffers of whatever city that you're in, it creates this situation where you're a criminal because you're poor. And I think these sort of things in the national conversation are actually increasingly being aired with publications addressing them, like and writers, individual writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates and all these other people who have studied this for generations. So I think it's important to recognize that there's not just one approach to this, but at the same time, I mean, we all, Chief Wilson, it would be a great day if you went to work and helped someone cross the street or like patted a kid on the back. And, you know, for me as an artist, it'd be great if I could sit and paint a watercolor and just like live my life, you know. And for the professor, it's like, you know, it'd be great to just go to work and, but that's not the reality. It's like our professions and our lives as African Americans have been hijacked by the politics and the circumstances of race in America that isn't being addressed on a national level consistently. It's only being reacted to. And until we can just sort of like say, hey, this happened, these are some things that we did to make this happen, and let's move forward from it, we're always going to have these conversations.
And I tend to disagree about the need for the conversation, and am concerned about the heavy lifting that people are not going to do when it comes to understanding systemic racism in the United States. And for me, the impetus is really just human empathy. The thing that we're seeing missing in so many of these cases is a recognition of another person's humanity. My ability to live, to occupy a space, and to stand up for myself. And I think until we stop predicating human empathy on, I need to be able to understand this from just my perspective, or I need to see this happen to someone who's like me, we're going to continue to have this conversation until we start recognizing other people as people equal and just as worthy as we are.
And I'll just add, if I may, that that sort of thing can't be legislated, but what can happen is that you can guarantee the basic human rights, equality, and justice for all citizens by enacting laws and, like, you know, enforcing those laws for everyone. So the one or two bad apples that are causing all these things to happen should face the full extent of the law, just like every person in America would if they did something that egregious. So I feel like it's important to be realistic about the minds that we're going to change, but it's also vital that we have legislation in place that ensures the equal right, the basic, the very basic equal rights and equality for everyone in our society, for everyone.
Chief, is there anything problematic, and please understand that I have great respect for the work that you do, is there anything problematic, though, with the narrative that we've seen, particularly in the 21st century, that says every cop is a hero?
Is it anything?
Is there a problem with that in that it seems like maybe some little children are raised to believe every cop will help you, every police officer is you know, there and to be trusted and obeyed, and other people have seen evidence that there is that, you know, whether it's 1% or 2% or 10% of officers that maybe need to be approached with caution, who may be in need of better training, who may be in need of better discipline in the field.
I I think we all, in law enforcement, we all start out for the greater cause, mm-hmm. to serve and protect. I think over the years, we've become more enforcers opposed to guardians and servants. And what I mean by that is that first, when you make that traffic stop and you stop them for no seatbelt, well, tell them why you stopped them for no seatbelt. Tell them what the statistical data says in regards to fatalities when you don't wear your seatbelt. Even if you have one that is a little upset that they were stopped and feel like it's their option if they should wear their seatbelt or not. But you always relate back to why you're doing it. And you open that conversation up. I've done it 1,000 times and I've received thank yous while giving them their citation because I explained that. It's nothing wrong with that type of customer service in law enforcement and respecting how they may feel. If a person works at McDonald's or they have to pay their electric bill and they just got a ticket. So they're making a very tough decision on, do I pay this ticket or do I pay my electric bill? Because if I don't pay this ticket, then I'm going to have a warrant out for my arrest. They're, you know, failure to appear citations, and it's a vicious cycle at that point.
Would it be helpful if we did what Christopher suggested and decriminalize certain things? So you might pull somebody over and give them a warning, but not be obligated to give them a citation for $75 or whatever, which is a real hit for people.
For Class C offenses, as far as moving violations, officers have that discretion already. Mm-hmm. They have that discretion. It's just a matter of, I would think, what they would, having that control or the authority to do it. And I teach a course on customer service and law enforcement, and we're going to have to soften our approach a little bit. Not more of that military stance and that more enforcing stance, but more of the more soft approach, especially when we're not just walking into a threatening situation and we're on a traffic stop. There are big differences. We're trained on how to make a traffic stop, and you can have that conversation. You can tell a person why you stopped them, give them your name, and remain professional. That consistency helps out when you have that real bad encounter because you treat everybody the same on each traffic stop. But what I want to say, the end result is, somehow it turns into altered biases. You didn't start that way, but along the way, working in this line of work, you have them and you don't recognize that you do. So it's something that each individual, as an officer, we have to continue to work against having those biases and understand why we're doing it.
That's our time for the hour. Thank you so much to my guests, Lancaster Police Chief Cheryl Wilson, artist, curator, and blogger Christopher Blay, and Assistant Professor of Journalism at UNT, Meredith Clark. It's been wonderful to have you all with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. My Twitter handle is @ChrisBoydThink. Show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.